reimagine going back into some of our workspaces.
And that wraps it up for this evening's Labor Radio. Let me remind all our listeners that KBOO.FM is where you can go to make a contribution to this community radio station, which is volunteer-run and listener-supported. We didn't have our spring membership drive this year, so if you're not yet a member or if it's time to renew, KBOO.FM. And that's it for tonight, every Monday night at 6 p.m. And stay tuned to Prison Pipeline.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
You're tuned into listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh, Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood.
Good evening. You are listening to Prison Pipeline here on KBOO Community Radio. Today we are talking with Paul Wright. Paul, let me make sure I've got this right. You're from the Human Rights Defense Center, is that correct?
Correct, and I'm the editor of Prison Legal News.
The editor of Prison Legal News, thank you so much. Tonight we're gonna be talking about the outbreak of COVID-19 in the prison system. In some prisons, there's one in Ohio in particular where 73% of all inmates have been recorded with COVID-19. Last week, we saw the first in a spate of deaths from COVID-19 within the prison system. Paul and his organization spend a lot of time monitoring and advocating for reform and for justice for incarcerated persons. And so we're going to talk tonight about what's going on. Paul, welcome to Prison Pipeline.
Hi, thanks for having me on the show.
Thanks. Paul, first of all, tell me a little bit about your organization. What does your organization do so people have a context?
Sure. This next month, we're celebrating the 30th anniversary that we've been publishing Prison Legal News, which is a monthly magazine that reports on criminal justice that I started while I was in prison in Washington State. I started the magazine in 1990, and we've published monthly since then, reporting on all aspects of detention facility news, litigation, and developments. And 2017, we started another publication called Criminal Legal News, which reports on developments related to the criminal law system and criminal law and procedure. And we also publish and distribute books related to the criminal justice system and doing legal research and helping basically prisoners advocate for themselves. We also do a lot of litigation, most of it centered around First Amendment free speech issues and also public records and government transparency, but we also do litigation occasionally around wrongful deaths in prison, as well as consumer class actions where prisoners and their families are being financially exploited by the criminal justice system.
Do you think that the way that, so we're going to be talking about COVID-19, but I understand that every system is different. We've got state prisons, we've got federal prison, we've got municipal jails. So, and of course, every state is different too. So the response that different communities are taking to COVID-19 really is wildly variable. But do you think that there's any examples of administrations or agencies actually ethically responding to the COVID-19 crisis within the prisons, based on what you've seen nationally?
No, based on what I'm seeing nationally, I haven't seen anyone that's doing much of anything or doing it correctly. I think the only thing that they can, the only thing that I think that's happened is some facilities, COVID has arrived sooner than it has in others. And I think that that's about the only thing that we have happening. I think the other thing, it also hampers getting any type of real, real snapshot or view of what's happening is, you know, literally the lack of government transparency and the secrecy that surrounds our nation's prisons and jails. You know, I would say that we don't really have a lot of, we don't have independent access to prisons and jails by media. For example, I'm not aware, since the COVID outbreak happened, I'm not aware of a single detention facility that has allowed independent journalists to enter the facility and to interview prisoners or just simply look around. I think that's one of the, that's one of many problems. But I think this also just faces the reality is that, for one, the bureaucrats that run the American police state when it comes to prisons and jails, basically they're security officials. You know, they're not public health officials, they're not doctors, especially at the local jail level. These are people that get elected based on what voters perceive as their qualities as literally policemen and law enforcement officials. So, you know, we haven't seen much in the way of leadership at the local jail level, and at the prison level, pretty much the responses have generally been fairly abysmal. I think a lot of this is just also the physical reality of prisons and jails is that, you know, it's literally about caging people in as little space as possible to cut down on costs. So these are decisions that have been made decades ago, starting with the fact that the United States built around 1,500 prisons in around the country in the 1990s, and virtually all these prisons were built in remote rural areas. And to an extent, the remote rural nature of so many prisons might be slowing down the rise or the spread of COVID in those facilities. But what we've seen is that once COVID gets a foothold in the facility, it tends to spread like wildfire. And I think that a lot of the reasons for this is the lack of any type of distancing or protective equipment, coupled with bad ventilation systems, inadequate sanitation, inadequate pretty much everything. Mm-hmm. And we also know that in the past 30 or 40 years, American prisons and jails have been ravaged by other pandemics and illnesses. And this ranges from MRSA, which is pretty much easily contained. All it requires is basic sanitation. And prisons and jails haven't been able to just have basic hand washing and soap and cleanliness to stop MRSA. Then you couple that with HIV and AIDS, hepatitis C, Legionnaire's disease, drug-resistant tuberculosis. You know, the list goes on, but those are the most common ones. And our prisons and jails have just been awash with all these other diseases and pandemics, and they've done an abysmal job of trying to contain illnesses that were not as contagious as COVID. And I don't think that there's any reason to believe, and we're certainly not seeing anything that makes us believe, that prison and jail officials are doing a better job with COVID than they did with all the other illnesses that have afflicted their prison population before now. And we're also not seeing anything that indicates that they want to try and do a better job.
So the kind of information that I've been getting has mostly been anecdotal. I don't even know where to go to find a clear count of how many people who are incarcerated right now have tested positive for COVID-19, or how many have died. Do you have any of those statistics?
No, I mean, we've been collecting the numbers like state or nationally, but so far it seems like at best we've seen several dozen deaths reported, but I think almost surely this is an undercount. Mm-hmm. And there's also the number of staff deaths that are also the warden and the medical officer of a prison in Louisiana have died of COVID. And I think that's interesting as COVID starts eating its way into the upper ranks of prison management. I'm wondering if that'll get their attention a little bit more than it has when it's just their lower line staff and prisoners that are being affected by this.
Anecdotally, what reports have you been getting from maybe even from incarcerated persons? Are you getting anecdotal reports from people about conditions?
Yes, we're getting a lot of letters. We're also getting phone calls from prisoners around the country, and pretty much everyone's saying the same thing, that people are getting sick, no one's getting medical treatment, and people are dying. And that seems to be, regardless of the prison system, you know, that seems to be the universal message that we're getting. You know, no one is saying anything like, you know, hey, we've been socially distanced, we've been able to effectively quarantine, we're getting prompt medical attention, we have face masks, we have sanitizer, we have soap, you know, nothing like that. I mean, it just is such a basic, and I think that's one of the things that's important to understand, is how American prisons and jails fail at such very basic things. Like, even under the best of circumstances, they weren't able to provide hand soap and sanitizer for prisoners. And then when you see the pictures of prisoners in dormitories, for example, I think it's important to note that as the United States has launched on its mass incarceration binge, it's really been mass incarceration by literally a bunch of cheapskates, in the sense that even as they spend billions of dollars, and literally the United States has spent over $1 trillion in the last 30 years building prisons and jails, even as we're spending all this money, they kind of want to do it as cheaply as possible. So they've used a lot of dormitory prisons, it's the cheapest way to cage people, but it's also the most insecure and unsafe, both from a security perspective and now, as it turns out, from a pandemic and a contagious disease perspective. When we look at these pictures where prisoners are being shoved into dormitories 3 and 4 feet away from each other on double bunks, and they're just being caged here, I think that it's obvious that there's no way that any type of social distancing can take place. And that's what's leading to the rise and the spread of COVID in these populations. I mean, some of these dormitories in Texas and Florida and Louisiana, for example, these are maximum security prisons, and you have 250, 300 prisoners jammed into one barracks, double bunked just a few feet away from each other. I think that it's just a matter of that, you know, when, but not if, COVID arises and gets its foothold into these facilities, that's when I think we're going to see even more problems than we've seen now. And I think that's only a matter of time. And I also think it's worth noting that the easiest way to avoid these problems is simply releasing prisoners and getting them out of prisons. I don't think that there's really any prison officials that are honestly saying that they're capable of coping with COVID in their prisons. They don't say anything, and at worst, they defend what mediocre actions they're taking. But I think when you look at other countries, I think the Iranian response, I think, is telling. They've released 85,000 prisoners, nearly a third of their prison population they've released on. I think that that's kind of a critical, you know, critical admission that the Iranian government realized they couldn't keep their prison population safe, and they released a third of their prison population, and they've hinted that they may wind up releasing more. That if they don't think they can safely contain the rest of their prison population, they're open to releasing more. And I think that that type of decisive action is, I think, what's sorely missing in this country. And I think it's also the reality, too, that when you think about it, if the United States prison and jail population of 2.5 million people were a city, it would be a city the size of Houston. And we're not hearing, and I think when you contrast the response of other government officials to COVID with that of prison and jail officials, I think it's even more telling. Look at university and school officials. Like, what have they done? You know, they've closed their campuses, they've closed their facilities, and their response is, we can't safely operate our schools, we can't safely operate universities, we can't protect our students, we can't protect our staff, we can't protect our faculty, therefore we're just gonna shelve everything and wait until this goes over. And I think any type of honest admission from prison and jail officials would be the same thing. But instead, I think this is almost the logic of the American police state, is they've kind of created the bars that cage themselves from a policy perspective, is having built this massive prison edifice and spent so much of the national wealth on it, they're not in a position to just say, you know what, we just send people home and we can just decarcerate vast numbers of our population because that's the only way to keep them alive. And I think that sadly, that the decarceration that the United States may see in the next year or two may very well be from so many people dying behind bars rather than getting released, because frankly, I think from the viewpoint of the people that run the American police state, people in prison are viewed as an expendable population.
Do you know anyone personally right now who's incarcerated, who's contracted COVID-19, Paul?
I don't know. None of the people that I'm in touch with in prison or jail have contracted COVID-19 that we know of at this point, and hopefully it stays that way. But one of the things that I think is worth noting is the difficulty of getting tested. And some facilities say they've performed tests, but it's one of those things where I question the ability to get tested, because outside of prison, for example, I don't know, I only know one person who's actually been tested. Mm-hmm. And that's because they were in the hospital for another matter. I don't know of anyone that's been able to get tested, even when they're having symptoms, even when they've been possibly exposed. Getting tested is not that easy outside of prison. And I'm not hearing that it's that easy to get tested inside of prison either. When I see some of these numbers, like I think it was the Louisiana or the Alabama prison system, I forget which one, that, you know, they have 30 or 40,000 prisoners and only a few hundred have been tested. And I also think one of the big contradictions here is that so many states have privatized their healthcare systems, and the business model of these companies is to provide as little medical care as possible while getting paid as much as possible. And I can see a pandemic really, you know, hitting those profit margins if they actually provided treatment. And I just don't see any of these companies sacrificing their profit margins for the lives of the prisoners that are being paid to take care of. Mm-hmm. So I think that that's another obvious conflict of interest, and one that unfortunately prisoners are going to pay the brunt of.
Here in Oregon, the Oregon Justice Resource Center filed a class action lawsuit on behalf of 7 incarcerated persons about 2 weeks ago, and it was filed against the Oregon Department of Corrections and Governor Kate Brown, calling for the release of vulnerable persons within the prison system. And it called for the, so ODOC came up with a list of about 3,500 people who were eligible or who could possibly be released early in order to help create social distancing within the prison system. And to date, the governor has taken no action. There's only been 2 people released. Can you comment on that? And are there similar cases pending in other states?
Yes, I think we've seen in some states, they've been pretty clear about that the governors were pretty clear that they're not going to release anyone. And for example, here in Florida, they're pretty clear about not releasing anyone. Other states, they've kind of hemmed and hawed and hedged and basically not done anything. So I think it literally depends on the state. But again, the lack of leadership from both the prison officials, who I think it's important to note are appointed by the governors of the states, and the Federal Bureau of Prisons, which is appointed by the president and the attorney general, and contrast that with the sheriffs who run most of our jails, who are elected officials. And no, we're not really seeing much of anything of movement. I think, you know, my analogy to this would be the Titanic, where, you know, the front row of the first row of passengers is put on lifeboats and sent on their way, and then the rest of the passengers and crew are left to their fate aboard the sinking ship. And I think that it's important to note that I think that the American police state has built such a mass of people that are imprisoned, like 2.5 million people. This is when you start counting everyone that's locked up in city jails, county jails, state prisons, federal prisons, then couple this with juvenile prisons and military prisons and immigration detention prisons around the country, and then Indian tribes that run their own detention facilities. This is how you're getting 2.5 million people locked up. And to actually make any sizable impact, the numbers that you'd have to be talking about would have to be they'd have to be very significant. And nothing like that is happening. I mean, I think that's the difference with Iraq, where they literally released a third of their prison population. Mm-hmm. 85,000 prisoners out of a total of around 270,000 were released. And I think it's worth noting that the Islamic Republic of Iran has an abysmal human rights record. You know, especially in the 1990s, they murdered literally tens of thousands of political prisoners. Their prison conditions are generally considered bad, even by Middle Eastern standards. And the fact that that government realized that they couldn't protect their prisoners from COVID and released a third of their prison population kind of, I think, indicates that probably the Islamic Republic of Iran values the lives of its prisoners more than the United States does at any government level.
It sounds like this is really just an extreme moment of crisis. The American penal system, really. It sounds like there's a moment of crisis with it right now, a profound moment of crisis. And it's revealing the vast inequities and injustices of how we deal with people who have committed, for the most part, really minor crimes.
Yes, and I think that in some respects, I think one of the things that's interesting is when you start looking at, you know, like who's being held in jail. The Pew Foundation recently did a report showing that vast numbers of the people are being held in jail because they can't afford a bail of $100. And it's literally, I think the issue is one of how bad and how poorly things are run and administered in this country when it comes to criminal justice. And I think the bigger thing is that prisoners are viewed as an expendable population. I don't think anyone running a prison or jail in this country is afraid that they're going to lose their job or be negatively impacted in their career if a bunch of prisoners die on their watch.
Mm-hmm.
Putting all the failings and the shortcomings of the American police state, especially as related to its prisons and jails, into a stark light. And I don't think that inadequate medical care or infectious disease, this is not new. And I think that the critical thing, I think it's also being ignored, as you're mentioning, is that of the staff. And yes, it is its own culture. I've heard it likened to, you know, we're doing a 30-year sentence 8 hours a day. But I think that one of the things that in a lot of respects I think also illustrates, I think, the poverty of the people that work in our nation's prisons and jails is the fact that they haven't pushed for better medical care for prisoners. And I think for one of the things that I've argued for a long time, for the 30 years that I've been doing Prison Legal News, is that prison health care is literally an issue that affects everyone. And by viewing prisoners as separate or outside of the public health realm, I think we've really done ourselves as a nation a disservice. Prisons and jails have been vectors of both HIV and hepatitis C for literally decades now, and nothing's been done about either one of those. One of the reports I've been following, you know, as a prisoner rights activist, I've been following AIDS for literally decades now, and it's an illness that hepatitis C are both illnesses that have seriously impacted prison populations. And it was interesting, I read an article or report a couple years ago that said that nationally 25% of the HIV positive population has some type of prisoner jail contact in the course of a given calendar year. And I would think that from an epidemiological viewpoint, that if you could interact with or connect with 25% of an infected population for any disease, that would be pretty significant and you would want to do something about it. And depending on the prison system, anywhere between 40 and 70% of prison populations are infected with hepatitis C, which is now, thanks to drug advances, is a curable disease. And instead, prison and jail officials have balked at doing anything for either illness unless they have to, and they all say cost. And I think this is the penny-wise, pound-foolish way of running a police state, because by focusing on short-term costs, the bigger public health implications of whether or not, you know, are more people going to get infected? Is it easier to treat hepatitis C when a person is infected but not showing any symptoms than it is waiting until they have end liver disease or whatever? And, you know, pretty much the police state answer, I think, is its own answer, as it shows that basically they view prisoners as an expendable population. They would rather not spend any money at all on treating them if they can, and then when they absolutely have to, give very mediocre and as little treatment as possible. And so, you know, so I think we've seen what the default response is to prisoners and illness in the past, and I'm not seeing anything that changes that. So
Paul, since we're kind of getting near the end of the show, and I want to thank you very much for being on today. We've been talking with Paul Wright, with Prison Legal News and the Human Rights Defense Center about the COVID-19 crisis in Americans' prisons. Paul, if we could think about if we actually, I mean, we do have the power, but if we could Absolutely. Think about the steps that we would want to take in order to secure the prison population right now, what would some of those steps be?
The most immediate one, I think, would be releasing large numbers of our prison population, which I think would be literally have to be on the order of probably 30 to 50% just to be able to achieve some type of social distancing within prisons. And I think in a lot of respects, that would mean getting prisons and jails down to their single cell or single rated capacities. If a prisoner is 75 years old and has asthma, it doesn't really matter if they were convicted of murder 30 years ago or if they were convicted of bouncing a check 5 months ago. Mm-hmm. You're going by a medical thing of this is the person who's vulnerable, this is the person you need to get out of a dangerous situation. And I think that's the thing. We don't look at things from a public health perspective in this country.
Paul, if people would like to get in touch with you, if they want to find out more about what's been going on with COVID-19, if they want to find out more about how to advocate for the rights of incarcerated people, how can they reach your organization?
Sure. The easiest way these days is just go to our website, prisonlegalnews.org, and our other website, criminallegalnews.org, and you'll find out everything you need.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood.
Thank you. KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
Tune in to KBOO on Wednesday, April 29th from 5.